Well, as we've discovered, the book of Esther is the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention God. None of the characters address God. And no work of divine providence is attributed to God by the writer. And yet, its story displays beyond doubt the presence and interaction of God. We have seen already, as we have looked at the characters of Esther and Mordecai, that their story has God written all over it. We have learned that Esther, the Jewish orphan, was being raised by her cousin Mordecai, who became her guardian. He was some kind of civil servant or official, and he was living in quarters at the palace in a place called Shushan. The king was Ahasuerus, in history known as Xerxes. And he chose Esther by this stage in the story to be Queen Vashti's replacement. And he did so through a lengthy process of elimination, and it came down to Esther. And he delighted in her. So, questions we have used to frame our thoughts so far have been, have I something that God could use? Because we've all got things that we can use and use for our own ends, but is there something that God could use? Then last time in our study, we used this question, can I lose sight of who I am? And we thought of a number of opportunities that Esther had to act differently to the way in which her guardian Mordecai would want her to act, or the way in which the Lord would want her to act. But she didn't. Can I lose sight of who I am? Well, this week's question is, does it matter to me what God thinks? Does it matter to me what God thinks? So we're in chapter 2, and at the end of verse 19, there's a little phrase there, Mordecai sat in the king's gate. And then in verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. Bigthan and Teresh, they're angry. Now, we're not told exactly why these men are angry. And although the story is really recorded from the perspective of the king's relationship with his queens, that's the main plot, if you like, in the story. There's obviously a lot more going on in the Persian Empire than just what we have documented for us here. In fact, historians believe that at this very time, Persia had suffered a number of defeats against the Greeks. So it may be that there was tension and unrest in the capital. Especially if you think about it, if they're suffering defeats and losses and so on in other places and in other battles. But here's the king having his celebrations and his feasts and banquets at the same time. So it could well have been something along those lines. They were wroth. And they sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Now, when you get that phrase, lay hands on, it wasn't like the laying on of hands in churches. This is a term which definitely in the Bible suggests violence, force. And that's not too good sounding, is it, in relation to the king? Verse 22, and the thing was known to Mordecai. So the conspiracy to lay hands on the king reached the ears of Mordecai. He may have overheard it. Now we need to stop there for a wee minute too. Remember, Mordecai is an exile here in Persian-controlled Babylon. He could quite easily, with many as another one, have held a grudge against his captors. He might well have wished ill to King Ahasuerus. But on the other hand, he hasn't done too badly under their rule either, as was the case for quite a number of the exiles, and is probably the reason quite a number didn't go back in any of the returns that we've dealt with so far. They stayed there, Persian-controlled Babylon, when they could have gone back to Israel and to Jerusalem. He's living in the precincts of a palace. There's not the worst place to live, I would think. He's a minor official, that would suggest he has good prospects. And again, as we are looking at this through all of these different stories, we'll eventually get to Nehemiah and we'll discover that he was the king's cupbearer. So there were opportunities to climb the ladder. So when he hears this conversation about a plot to assassinate the king, which really amounted to treason, he has a dilemma on his hands. What would he do? I suggest that the thought has occurred to Mordecai that if King Ahasuerus was to be eliminated, what would happen to Esther? The very least Mordecai can do is to warn Esther. So the thing was known to Mordecai, beginning of verse 22, who told it to Esther, the queen. Now, that's all the writer tells us about this chain of events so far. We're not told if Mordecai gave her any instructions, because he has given her instructions previous to this. Not told if he warns her further than to say, this is what has happened, and maybe he says, look, you need to do this or do that or escape or whatever. All we know is that Mordecai made sure that Esther knew about the plot. And that then throws the spotlight onto her. What would Esther do? Because this is serious stuff here. You imagine being her, even being Mordecai, living in that environment and all of this going on. This is serious stuff. So, back to verse 22. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And here's what she does. And Esther certified or informed the king thereof in Mordecai's name. Somehow, and we don't know how she arranged it on this occasion, because we're going to see how she manages things on another occasion, but somehow we don't know how she did it, but she informed the king of this treasonous plot. She's no more than Mordecai's word for this story. And I'm sure had it been anybody else, Esther mightn't have taken them just quite so seriously. But I believe in this incident, we see how much faith Esther still has in her guardian, Mordecai. She has faith in his assessment. The fact that he took time and went to the effort to get the news to her, it says something to her because it's coming from him. Isn't it good in life to have people whose word we can take and people we can trust? And there might be many as a person who'd say something to us and we would go, oh, that's her, she exaggerates, or he said something to me before and there wasn't a bit of truth to it. And we know people like that. But I hope in your life and in mine we also know people, and if they say something we'll go, well, do you know something? If he said it or if she said it, it must be right. And here we have such a situation. So she finds a way of convincing the king of his danger, and she's successful. Now, she could well have taken the credit for, if you like, saving the crown. After all, that was a pretty major act of valor, wasn't it? That was a big day. But she doesn't. She could have sought some kind of extra reward. I mean, she was pretty well looked after, as I mentioned, in relation to Vashti. The king had made an enormous investment in these women. But she didn't look for anything over and above what she had. She informs the king in Mordecai's name. In other words, it's Mordecai you have to thank. We could say that Mordecai and Esther were behaving here like Persian loyalists. But I believe these exiled cousins were close in relationship. They'd had to live apart now for some years, but you can still see that that closeness is there. And it's quite possible, and I believe it's borne out in the narrative, that they had the same moral values. In fact, it may even be that Mordecai knew what she would be thinking at times, and she knew what he would be thinking. If that's so, then neither of them could stand by and allow wickedness to prevail when it was in their power to do something about it. Neither of them could stand by and let wickedness prevail when it was in their power to do something about it. Sometimes we fall down at that one, don't we? Beginning of verse 23. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out, or found to be exactly as she had said. The king didn't ignore Esther. And that lets you see something else about her testimony in the palace precincts. And we've mentioned before about certain parallels in this story, because as we've mentioned it now every week, there's no time when God is called upon or named and so on. But we can see things that happen in this story happening in other stories, and they are clearly attributed to God. There are parallels. And one of the parallels is in Joseph's character again. Because do you remember the advice Joseph gives to Pharaoh regarding the famine? And Pharaoh takes him seriously. This Jewish person came from nothing. Here's Esther, an exile. And yet, they are both taken seriously because of their life and the integrity that is seen by others in them. So the king investigates, and the lead that he's been given is right enough. So there's a case to answer. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out, therefore they, that's Bigtan and Teresh, were both hanged on a tree. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So they may have written it in the king's presence, or they may have written it in this book, which remains in front of the king in some ceremonial way. So that seemingly trivial little detail, that it was actually written in the book, you plant that thought in your mind, because it's going to be important later on. So it's not there for no reason. It was written in this book. So crisis has been averted. But apart from writing this into this book, there has been no further recognition. He's just mentioned in dispatches, we would say. But nothing beyond that. So into chapter 3, verse 1. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now you would have thought that we would have gone straight into a verse that would have said, after this the king advanced Mordecai. Because we saw that in relation to Daniel and the three friends, when they stood out and shone and showed who was the God of Israel. But now the story turns into a new chapter, and it's a new development. The king advances Haman, and he's described here as the son of an Agagite. Now, remember we talked about contrasts, and the contrast between Mordecai and Haman, and we have a wee bit of Mordecai's genealogy. Now we have a wee bit of Haman's, and there is that little contrast there. So, what's an Agagite? Well, some folk think that there may have been a province in the Persian-controlled empire that was called Agag. But when you bring that down through, it doesn't make much sense to the rest of the story. It doesn't add anything. In fact, it's maybe somebody's attempt to explain things away. But what we do know from the word of God is that there was an Agag who was a king of the Amalekites. And if Haman was a descendant of Agag, who was an Amalekite, then that made Haman an Amalekite. Why would that matter? Does that shed any light on anything at all? Well, here's a very stern warning found way back in the book of Exodus, chapter 17 and verse 16. The Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And you could go to Deuteronomy and other books. Amalek is mentioned over and over and over again, never in a good light and always consistently as the enemy of the people of God. That's established. On one occasion, God told King Saul to wipe out the Amalekites. Every trace of them. Livestock, the lot. And we read about this in 1 Samuel 15. But Saul thought he knew better. And he decided to keep the livestock. And he even spared the king of the Amalekites. And of course Samuel had to come against him. To obey is better than sacrifice. Saul says, see all these animals that I've spared? Sure, we can use these for the glory of God. We can bring them in and look at how many sacrifices we can make unto God. Samuel says, that's not the point. God said you were to do something and you didn't do it. Samuel himself had to, the prophet had to kill the king. Now, all these centuries later, here's an Amalekite, an Agagite, who's alive and well, and he's walking round Shushan. And he's just been elevated by King Ahasuerus. Verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did reverence him. Now, this is serious stuff because the king has commanded this should be the way. This is the new protocol. This is what should happen. When you see Haman coming, you're to acknowledge him. But Mordecai is saying no. He comes and goes from the king's gate. Nothing unusual in that. But we sometimes underestimate what the Bible means when it says the gate, in the gate, sitting in the gate. Because the gates of cities and towns were places where, it's a bit like the Royal Exchange in the children's talk earlier, a lot of business was done in the gate. Elders sat in the gate and made decisions. And all kinds of oaths were sworn in the gate. So it was a designated place in its own right. Things happened there. And Mordecai and Haman seem to have been frequent visitors. So they mightn't just have been passing through. Business may have been done here. And all the other officials bowed down when they saw Haman coming, with one exception, Mordecai. Why did he behave like that? Especially if, as some people think, that this is just a man from a place called Agag, there's no connection at all with the Amalekites, then why would this be an issue? Because there's actually nothing in the law of God that says you couldn't show reverence and due respect to a king. Verse 3 of Esther 3, then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? So they want to know. Now it came to pass when they spake daily unto him, so they didn't give up. Every time they noticed this happening, and it was happening daily, they said, why are you doing this? They weren't getting an answer. He paid no attention to them. Maybe he felt it was safer not to do that. But they then go a wee step further. They think, well, we're going to find out what's going on here. and they mention it to Haman. So he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now that's not there for no reason. There's where we get our connection. There's a connection between Mordecai not bowing and Mordecai being a Jew. And that's why we believe we're thinking in context here as we put our thoughts together. This is interesting. Mordecai, being a Jew, is refusing to give reverence to Haman. And when you make the contrasts and carry it over, Haman the Amalekite. Now you're maybe thinking what I'm thinking. Mordecai knew enough of Old Testament history to know what God thought of the Amalekites. What I'm suggesting is that Mordecai saw more than just a man. And Haman's going to do this as well with Mordecai. He's going to see more than a man. He's going to see a nation. And there's contrasts here. And Mordecai sees more than a man. He sees a remnant of a nation that was abhorrent to God. And if that's true, then it's fair to say that it mattered to Mordecai what God thought. And there's our question. Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? You ask yourself that question. Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? And how would we know what God thinks? We have it here. Now, Mordecai didn't set out to kill Haman. He didn't injure him. He didn't set out to take anything from him. He didn't strike out at his family or other people that he would know to have been Amalekites. Mordecai didn't set out to do any of those things. He just couldn't bring himself to bow to somebody he knew was abhorrent to God. Verse 5, and when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, possibly never noticed before, probably that full of himself, but the fact that these other officials have come to him and said, what's going on here with this? Now we read, when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Or in other words, he poured scorn on the idea of only going after Mordecai. He thought, that's not enough. I'm so angry. I'm going to go as far as I can with this. And they had showed, of course, Mordecai's people. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Now, this seemingly small action, this act of conscience, has got massive ripples now. It's because of Mordecai's Jewishness that this act of disrespect is being done, as reported by the king's officials. And if that's the case, Haman wants to get rid of all the Jews. Not just all in that immediate vicinity, in all the kingdom. That's clear, that's emphasized. Verse 7, in the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Pur, the casting of the lot, from which we have the Jewish feast of Purim, which is the feast of lots, and we'll explain that in a wee bit more detail as we go along. So commentators suggest that this was a means of fixing a date for the execution of all the Jews. Verse 8, and Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all the people. Now, it's not that long since we were in the book of Ezra. And remember that King Artaxerxes there expressly asked Ezra, when you go back, I want you to make sure that you get these laws implemented. Your laws. And we talked about how he knew that that would be a good way of getting people to live to a high standard of morality within their setting. So how different is he, how different is that king to this king? And here these laws are being put forward as a negative thing by Haman. He's just against God. So something has come down through in his life. Their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's prophet to suffer them. Neither keep they the king's laws. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand, gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. Now, what a title to have. See anybody in this world today in the 21st century? Woe betide them if they get this name, the Jews' enemy. They'll answer for that. That's a serious thing to be called the Jews' enemy. Verse 11, and the king said unto Haman, the silver is given thee, the people also to do with them as it seemeth good unto thee. So the king is going to fund this annihilation. He's going to give them the manpower, give Haman the manpower to do it. And he's going to make sure this is signed and sealed and put into writing. This is official. Verse 12. Then the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, to the governors that were over every province. Remember, Israel's a province. And to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of the king Ahasuerus, was it written and sealed with the king's ring. And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. Even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is in the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. An extermination of all Jews and a confiscation of all their goods, resulting in what we call today a Holocaust that would literally pay for itself. And not only that, the king would end up with money in his coffers. Verse 14, a copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. The posts went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And here's a sad little line. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. It's not the first time leaders were out of touch with their people, isn't that right? Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, so now he knows the plan. What would he think now? Was he thinking, oh, I've just made things worse? This is a time, isn't it, for what ifs? Are you going through a time in your life, a time of what ifs? What if I hadn't made that choice? What if I hadn't gone down that road? What ifs? Young people here today, try by leaning heavily on the Lord and looking to the Lord and asking for guidance from the Lord. Try to not have a life of what ifs. He could have been thinking, why did I do that? What if all the Jews had returned to the promised land instead of staying in Babylon? They'd never have come in contact with Haman. What if Mordecai hadn't refused to nod? What if he had just ignored what God thought of this man? Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? When Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes, put on sackcloth with ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry, and came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, and weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. And again, there's a mental note for you to make there when we get to the book of Nehemiah. The fact that Mordecai couldn't come in to the king's presence wearing the signs of mourning or sackcloth and ashes. So the Jews, the fellow Jews, the king's people of Mordecai, they don't turn on him. It's interesting that the writer stops short of saying things that we think should be there. And they are there, he just hasn't written them. Because he says they cried, but they were obviously crying to God. They were in sackcloth and ashes. Again, we see the parallels that take us out of this book to other occasions, and every other one of them is, it's a sign of earnestness and expression of their real need before God, their desperation before God. The writer just hasn't put that in here. But it's every bit as obvious, every bit as real. They're crying, of course, to God. They're disfiguring themselves to show that nothing in this world is of any consequence anymore. I am completely focused on this issue. My life doesn't matter. This is important, that God steps in for the sake of the nation. Verse 4, so Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it to her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. Then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, so she had her butler. And he gave a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. So although she's told that Mordecai is behaving this way, she's not told why. And therefore she has to go and find out. So Hatak went forth to Mordecai into the streets of the city, which was before the king's gate. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him and of the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Also he gave him a copy. He says, here, this is the flyer that they're sending round. This is the summons that we build. There it is. Take that and show it to Esther and declare it unto her. End of verse 8. Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? It mattered to Mordecai, but should it matter to Esther? Well, you see, it mattered to Samuel what God thought about the Amalekites way back there in 1 Samuel 15. But it didn't seem to matter to Saul. Result, Saul lost the throne. I think of Elimelech in the book of Ruth. He chose to forsake his fellow countrymen during a time of famine, and we spent quite a bit of time discussing that. He headed where? To Moabite territory. You'll discover something similar said of the Moabites in Moab, as I said, of the Amalekites. What happened to Elimelech and his sons? They died. Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? Well, in conclusion this morning, let's ask ourselves some very serious questions. Because we have our Bibles. What does God think about marriage? Does it matter? Is it what I think? Or is it what God thinks? What does God think when two become one flesh? Go to the Word of God. What does God think about gender? Does it matter? Is it up to what I think? What others think? What the majority thinks? Does it matter what God thinks? What does God think about sexuality? Does it matter? It does matter. How do we know? We have with His Word. We must go to His Word. What does God think of the sanctity of all life? The unborn? Does it matter to God? Should then it matter to us? What does God think about worship? Again, do we just go with what's on trend? Or do we want to know what God thinks about worship? What about apostasy? What does God think about idolatry? Things that take over our lives are more important than Him. Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? What does God think about my commitment to His work? The commitment of every believer to His work. We're all servants of the living God. What does God think of my input into assembly life? Is that just a casual thing? Is that something we can find excuses for? Oh, I can only come out now once a week, Pastor. What does God think about the evangelism of others? Has anybody been reached? What does God think about my intercession and prayer? Does it matter what God thinks about things? Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? I trust these questions, as we see them being answered for us in this story, will live with us, and that God will even be able to use them for His glory.